reading of Sports Today, a one-hour reading of sports news from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday and Thursday. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin today's reading with a headline that reads, All four number one seeds headed to the men's Final Four. Dateline Atlanta. Johnny Broome had 25 points and 14 rebounds, and Auburn took command with 17 unanswered points in the first half to beat Michigan State 70-64 on Sunday and complete a sweep of number one seeds advancing to the men's Final Four. Auburn, with a record now of 32 wins, 5 losses, earned its second Final Four trip, while Michigan State, with a record of 30 wins, 7 losses, fell short of its bid to send coach Tom Izzo to his ninth national semifinal. Auburn's only previous Final Four appearance came in the year 2019, also under head coach Bruce Pearl. The South Region champion Tigers, the top overall seed in the NCAA tournament, became the last of the number one seeds to advance to the Final Four, joining Florida, Duke, and Houston. It's the first time all top seeds have reached the Final Four since the year 2008, which was the only previous year of all number one seeded semifinalists since the tournament expanded to 64 teams in the year 1985. Jackson Kohler led the Spartans with 17 points and 11 rebounds. In Indianapolis, Houston's relentless defense confused and harassed Tennessee and carried the Cougars into their seventh Final Four and their first since the year 2021, with L.J. Cryer scoring 17 points in a 69-50 victory on Sunday. Emmanuel Sharp scored 14 of his 16 points after halftime for top-seeded Houston, whose record is now 34 wins, 4 losses, and he was named the region's most outstanding player. Houston extended the nation's longest active winning streak to 17 games. The Cougars had been eliminated as a number one seed in the Sweet 16 in each of the past 2 years, but this year, Coach Kelvin Sampson's team has a shot at the program's first national title. The Cougars will face Cooper Flagg and five-time national champion Duke on Saturday in San Antonio, just a 3.5-hour drive from campus. Chaz Lanier and Tucsonan Jordan Ganey scored 17 points apiece for the second-seeded Tennessee Volunteers, whose record fell to 30 wins, 8 losses, and again fell short of the program's first Final Four appearance. And Villanova hired Maryland's Kevin Willard as its new head coach on Sunday to replace the fired Kyle Neptune. Willard had been linked to the Villanova job throughout the NCAA tournament, where the Terrapins earned a number 4 seed and reached the Sweet 16 before losing to Florida. Maryland went 27 wins, 9 losses this season, and 14 wins, 6 losses in the Big Ten. And New Mexico hired University of California San Diego's Eric Olin on Sunday as its next men's basketball coach. Olin will replace Richard Pitino, who left to become Xavier's coach on Tuesday. Olin spent 21 years at San Diego, the last 12 as head coach, and guided the Tritons through their transition from Division II to Division I. And in women's college basketball news, In Spokane, Washington, Lauren Betts had 17 points and 7 rebounds despite spending the entire second quarter on the bench. And top overall seed UCLA reached its first Final Four of the Women's NCAA Tournament with a 72-65 victory over LSU on Sunday. The 6'7" Betts added 6 blocks for the Bruins, whose record now is 34 wins, 2 losses, and will face the winner of Monday's game between Southern Cal and UConn. Gabriela Jaquez had 18 points and 8 rebounds for the Bruins, and Tamia Gardner finished with 15 points, helping to pick up the slack as Betts went to the bench after committing 2 first-quarter fouls. And from college basketball news, let's turn now to some baseball news. Headline reads, Texas Rangers DeGrom returns hopeful. This feature written by Bob Nightingale, columnist for USA Today. Dateline, Surprise, Arizona. Kids are standing on the backfields of the Texas Rangers spring training complex, getting autographs from everyone wearing a uniform when Jacob DeGrom emerges. Parents tug on their kids' arms, whisper in their ears, tell them to drop what they're doing and go grab DeGrom's signature. Suddenly, there are more than 100 kids surrounding DeGrom, most of whom have never seen him pitch, let alone suit up for the Rangers. But they're taking the advice from their giddy parents that this 36-year-old man must be pretty important. They're told that this man just may be one of the greatest pitchers in baseball when healthy. The problem, of course, is that he just hasn't been healthy. It has been 6 years since DeGrom last pitched a full season, capturing his second consecutive Cy Young Award. It has been 4 years since he has pitched more than 96 innings in a season. It has been nearly 3 years since he signed a 5-year, $185 million free agent contract with the Rangers, pitching just 41 innings the past 2 seasons. Obviously, they have taken a toll, DeGrom tells USA Today Sports. You feel the disappointment. You feel terrible. I haven't been out on the field nearly as much as I'd like to be. You feel like you're letting everybody down because you're not playing. And that hurts. It hurts bad. Unquote. Now, after 2 Tommy John surgeries and a litany of injuries later, hoping to prove to the world, most of all to himself, that he once again can be the most dominant pitcher in the game, perhaps still giving himself a shot at Cooperstown. He feels as good as he has in years. The fastball velocity is back to 98 miles per hour. His curveball and slider are crisp. The changeup is lethal, and the pinpoint control has returned. If DeGrom is throwing in the bullpen, Rangers rookie starter Jack Leader says, it's pretty much a stop-and-watch kind of event. Anybody in the area is putting down what they're doing and watching because it's probably the most impressive bullpen that anyone has ever seen, unquote. And when he is healthy and pitching in games, well, there may be no one better. He's a unicorn, Rangers pitching coach Mike Maddox says. He plays catch at 95 miles an hour and commands the ball. His stuff is as good as anybody's in the game, and he commands the ball as good as anybody I've seen. Most guys that have that kind of velocity are like blow-and-go guys. He's driving it through a spot pretty consistently. He's kind of like a Lamborghini, you know. He's got to be finely tuned. Once he gets in those lanes, he'll start stepping on the gas a little bit, and he'll be just like he was a few years ago, unquote. There was a 5-year span with the New York Mets when Jacob deGrom was the best pitcher in baseball. He won 2 Cy Young Awards, finished in the top 10 in Cy Young voting 5 seasons, led the league in strikeouts twice, won an ERA title, and was so dominant in 2021, he actually had more hits himself than earned runs that he allowed in the season. You can make the argument that he's in the category of the most dominant pitcher of all time, says Rangers outfielder Kevin Pillar, who also played with DeGrom with the Mets. It's just the perfect blend of power and finesse and accuracy. He's the perfect pitcher when healthy. I've been on 10 teams now, and I've been around a lot of healthy, good pitchers, great pitchers, but there was nothing like coming out of the dugout in New York when he was on top of his game. Simple man was playing and feeling like you were about to witness history. I've never seen anything like him, unquote. It was just those injuries, everything from the elbow, shoulder, forearm, wrist, back, neck, side, and hamstring, along with Tommy John surgeries, keeping him from perhaps going down as one of the finest pitchers in history. You know, I try not to look at things that way, DeGrom says. There's a lot of things that could be different. You cannot play the what-ifs. It's out of your control. You do everything you can to stay out there. If somebody knew exactly what would work, then nobody would get hurt. Some guys go their whole careers with nothing. The reality is that it happened, unquote. DeGrom, married with 3 kids, made just 6 starts into his free agent contract before having Tommy John surgery in June of 2023. He broke down in tears in front of TV cameras and reporters at a press conference to announce the decision. He even pulled a few of us aside, former teammate Travis Jankowski says, and he told us, "Man, I just feel like I'm letting the whole team down. I am so sorry." He felt like he was letting our GM, Chris Young, down. He felt like he was letting his teammates down, the city down. You go through an injury like that first year after signing the contract, and he felt terrible. We said, "Dude, you're 1% of a 1% of a 1% pitcher. This isn't something that you were out on a jet ski and fell off and broke your arm. Dude, this is an injury that happened in the game. You have nothing to feel bad about. We're going to pick you up. Then, in the coming years, it's on you," unquote. Now is that time, and really, even though DeGrom has made only 9 starts for the Texas Rangers, his health really hasn't cost them. The Rangers won the World Series without him in 2023. They went 78 wins, 84 losses, and finished 10.5 games out of first place in the American League West last year. So, even if he were healthy, the Rangers weren't going to do better than winning the World Series 2 years ago, and likely still wouldn't have made the postseason last year. Really, the way that the Rangers see it, DeGrom is arriving healthy just at the right time. "Obviously, I haven't been on the field nearly as much as I'd like to be," DeGrom says. "As a player, you feel like a disappointment because you're supposed to be out there. You leave it all out there on the field, and it's then taken away from you. It just stinks," unquote. Can you imagine DeGrom's career if he was healthy the entire time? In DeGrom's 4 seasons in which he pitched 200 innings, he went 50 wins, 35 losses, with a 2.53 ERA, striking out 968 batters in 913 innings. In the year 2018, he was the best pitcher in the majors, going 10 wins, 9 losses, with a 1.70 ERA, striking out 269 batters and walking only 46 in 217 innings. DeGrom refuses to feel sorry for himself or curse at the heavens or lament his fate. He knows he feels as good as he ever has and believes that he can be dominant once again and isn't about to worry about the past. "This game is funny," DeGrom says. "Throwing the baseball is bad for you, right? All you can do is play this game, and we're very fortunate to do it. It's what you love to do. All the prep that goes into it and all the off-season training, then it's taken away from you. It shines new light on it. I had my second Tommy John surgery, and I did my rehab. You're upset that it happened, sure, but you can't get yourself down about it. So here we go. Let's see what we can do moving forward," unquote. DeGrom, who was able to make 3 starts at the end of last season and showing flashes of his brilliance, averaging 97 miles an hour on his fastball and yielding a 1.69 ERA with 14 strikeouts in 10 and two-thirds innings, he went home to Florida and was finally able to have a normal off-season. He felt like himself again and had a normal off-season workout routine. He tinkered with his delivery, believing his arm path got a little long, so he shortened it. He also has tried to ease up on his velocity, wanting to believe that he can get the job done just as well throwing 95 or 96 miles per hour rather than 101. "The trouble is that it's easier said than done," DeGrom says. "It's a thing that you fight with when a batter steps into the box. It's go time. Where I struggle with it is that I throttle down and somebody hits a home run and you're like, well, what if I didn't throttle down? Maybe that wouldn't have been the result. So it's going to be something that I play with. Locations win most of the time. I've got to get back to that, and we'll see," unquote. The Rangers plan to be cautious with DeGrom, making him the 5th starter to ease his workload, giving him extra days when needed. DeGrom still wants to make 30 starts, but the Rangers want to make sure that he is healthy come October. They plan on being back in the postseason, and who in the world would want to face a healthy DeGrom in the postseason? Quote, "He looks good, and when he's smiling like he is, he makes everybody feel good," unquote, Mike Maddox says. Who knows? If DeGrom returns like the DeGrom of old, stays healthy, he still could be a candidate one day for Cooperstown. While his focus is on winning another World Series, he would be lying if the Hall of Fame didn't cross his mind. He also knows that he needs to stay healthy and rack up innings. He has pitched only 1,367 innings, which is nearly 1,000 innings fewer than Sandy Koufax's 2,324 innings total. Obviously, the highest honor you can get is to be elected to the Hall of Fame, says DeGrom. That was the goal. "There are some things that set me back, but I think I've got some years ahead of me to keep doing this, so we'll see where that takes me." As a kid, you dream of being a baseball player, and then to play at the highest level, it's pretty special. I've been able to do some pretty cool things in my career, but I know that's in the past too. So my goal is to put up zeros, put my team in a position to win, and wherever that takes me, we'll see. All I know is I'm ready. I'm excited to be out there. I cannot wait to see what's ahead." Unquote. Neither, of course, can anyone else. It's the perfect time, Kevin Pillar says, for him to be an ace again. Unquote. And again, that feature entitled "Texas Rangers Jake DeGrom Returns Hopeful," written by Bob Nightingale, columnist for USA Today. And in another baseball feature, this one's headline reads, "Tampa Rays and the A's Must Adapt to Minor League Baseball Parks." This feature written by Joe Mock. In the year 2009, Carrie Underwood brought tears to the eyes of country music fans with her number one hit, "Temporary Home." She sang of a child being shuttled from foster family to foster family, and a dying man who's about to leave this life to enter his heavenly home. "This is my temporary home. It's not where I belong," the chorus tells us, adding, "This is just a stop on the way to where I'm going." Two major league teams enter the 2025 regular season feeling like their journeys belong in a country song. Their heartaches, joys, and frustrations are the stuff of Nashville hitmakers. For the Tampa Bay Rays, what they thought was a solid plan to build a new stadium started to unravel due to Hurricane Milton, forcing them to play this season across Tampa Bay from St. Petersburg. And the Athletics, whose lack of a geographic identifier symbolizes the temporary nature of their trek, will be in a minor league park 86 miles from their home for the past 57 summers. Last summer, the front office of the Tampa Bay Rays was both relieved and overjoyed, following 17 years of concerted effort to obtain a replacement for dreadful Tropicana Field, a deal had finally been struck with the two governmental entities that mattered. On July 18th, the St. Petersburg City Council voted to approve a $6.5 billion development to be constructed next door to the Trop, with the Rays tapped to spearhead it. At the start of this historical gas plant district would be a shiny new fixed-roof stadium projected to cost $1.3 billion. The city indicated that it would contribute $288 million specifically for the ballpark. 12 days later, the Pinellas County Commission also approved the development, pledging $312 million for the stadium. The Rays would be responsible for the other half of the venue's cost, ostensibly recovering some of that with higher revenue from the new facility and money generated by the overall development. The Rays announced that their new state-of-the-art showplace would debut on opening day of 2028. Planning on the development and the stadium began in earnest. When last October arrived, you can almost hear the mournful wail of a pedal steel guitar. Hurricane Milton ravaged the Gulf Coast of Florida, making the tattered shreds of the Tropicana's roof an enduring symbol of the storm's fury. Partially because of the widespread devastation in the area, votes to issue stadium construction bonds that were supposed to be a formality were postponed by the city and county. By the time that those approvals arrived in December, the Rays had concluded that the already tight timeline for a 2028 delivery date was no longer possible. And a year's delay meant over $100 million in higher construction costs and millions more in lost revenue that a new venue would have provided in 2028. So the Rays, who claimed that they had already invested $50 million in architecture and planning on the new development, abruptly stopped all such expenditures. A March 31st deadline to accept or reject the public money to build a delayed stadium loomed. Stu Sternberg, managing partner of the Rays since the year 2005, ended one type of drama but created another on March 13th. He released a statement saying that the team was not moving forward with the plan for a new ballpark or the historic gas plant district development. In other words, the Rays decided that the agreement that had been reached last summer with the city and county was dead. A series of events beginning in October that no one could have anticipated led to this difficult decision, Sternberg's statement says in part. Reaction was swift, with St. Petersburg Mayor Ken Welch telling reporters that he viewed the decision as a major disappointment. He added that it is preferable to learn the Rays' intentions now rather than after construction bonds had been issued. It's better to get out of a bad engagement than a bad marriage, the mayor surmises. Then word leaked out that Steinberg was actively negotiating to sell the franchise. He didn't want to bind new owners to a commitment to the St. Pete project if they wanted to move the team elsewhere. Prospective ownership groups quickly emerged, each with its own idea of where the team should build a new park. One group wants to build a new stadium in Orlando, another in Tampa, another in Nashville, and yet another next to the Trop in St. Petersburg. Welch welcomes discussions with new owners, adding that he has no interest in further talks with Sternberg, even if they involved a major rebuilding of the Tropicana with a 10-year lease extension. That bridge has been burned, he says. While Tampa, already home to the NFL and the NHL, would be a logical landing spot, the Rays would face opposition from other owners if they want to abandon the growing Tampa Bay market altogether. Amid the swirling drama of the stadium situation, the Rays accepted the offer of the Yankees to play the 2025 regular season in their spring training stadium in Tampa, which has just undergone $50 million in improvements. The Yankees, Florida State League team that usually plays at Steinbrenner Field, will move their home games to an upgraded practice field next door. And when the Yankees come to Tampa to take on the Rays in a series that starts on April 17th, New York will be using the visitor clubhouse in their own ballpark. Since the summer months see plenty of hot, humid, often stormy weather around Tampa Bay, Major League Baseball changed the Rays' regular season schedule. The Rays will now host 16 series in Tampa prior to July the 4th, and only another 5 prior to Labor Day. The current plan calls for this to be a one-year arrangement. The city of St. Petersburg is contractually responsible for the Trop, so they've announced that they will spend approximately $56 million to repair its roof and all of the wreckage on the interior. Completing the work would allow the Rays to move back there for the 2026 season. And after that, the ending of that song has not been written yet. The story of the Athletics might lack the ongoing intrigue of the Tampa Bay Rays, but it's had no less drama. On the afternoon of September 19th, 2024, the Athletics played the ultimate getaway game. With the team mired in last place with no hope of making the playoffs, the baseball world knew that it would be the final contest at the Oakland Coliseum. In 2023, Major League Baseball owners granted the Athletics the right to move to Las Vegas, following the same path out of town as their NFL brethren, the Oakland Raiders. This fall, the Las Vegas Raiders will play their sixth season at Allegiant Stadium across Interstate 15 from the famous Strip. The A's plan to occupy a new stadium that will soon be constructed on the site of the now-demolished Tropicana, one of the Strip's legendary hotel casinos. It might be a stretch, but if construction goes perfectly, the new venue could be ready by the year 2028. That schedule means that the A's had to find an interim home for 3 years at least. Many options were examined, but playing inside air-conditioned Allegiant Stadium was not one of them, since its design cannot accommodate a baseball field. More viable options, including sharing Oracle Park with the San Francisco Giants, playing in the AAA ballparks in Reno or the Summerlin suburb of Las Vegas, or moving to the 28th biggest metro area in the U.S. That would be Sacramento. The capital city of California already had a major league level sports team in the NBA's Kings. In fact, the Kings own the Sacramento Rivercats, the AAA baseball team that plays at Sutter Health Park in West Sacramento. When this opportunity came about, we wanted to make sure that we let everybody know that Sacramento would be a great landing spot for the A's in their transition to Las Vegas, John Reinhart, the Kings president of business operations, tells USA Today Sports, quote, "Obviously, the A's know what they're doing, and they've seen the support that the Sacramento region has for its sports teams," unquote. The Kings and the A's entered into an agreement to split the cost of significant upgrades to the minor league park and will share the ongoing expenses and revenue while the big league team is in Sacramento. This move means that the ballpark will see almost daily use, with both the Rivercats and the A's playing their full home schedules there. Because of the pounding that the playing surface will take, artificial turf was slated to be installed. Instead, after the Major League Baseball Players Association balked, the surface will continue to be natural grass. It is scheduled to be replaced mid-season, perhaps during the All-Star break. The biggest addition to Sutter Health Park is a two-story structure beyond left field that will serve as the A's clubhouse. Other upgrades include bigger bullpens and dugouts, new light towers, more batting tunnels, a new video board, and expanded hospitality areas for fans. "I think that we have proven that we can share the spaces," says Reinhart. Rivercats fans and players will be able to enjoy all of these new experiences that they didn't have before, unquote. It's an interesting irony that the Athletics are likely to experience an impressive bump in attendance in the significantly smaller venue this year, as most games in the 14,000-capacity park will be sold out. The team won't be adopting the name Sacramento A's during their stay, though. To the chagrin of a number of media outlets, they will go without a geographic destination until they move to Las Vegas. That doesn't bother Reinhardt. Everybody is very excited for the impact that we're about to make in the region, unquote. For both the A's and the Rays, their surroundings this season will simply be a stop on the way to where they're going, as Carrie Underwood might sing. If either team can grab a playoff berth under their trying circumstances in 2025, the achievement would certainly warrant its own hit song. And again, this feature is entitled "The Rays and the A's Must Adapt to Minor League Parks," written by Joe Mock of baseballparks.com. And from baseball news, let's turn now to some football news. Headline reads, "Detroit Lions are right. NFL playoffs are long due for an overhaul." This feature written by Nate Davis of USA Today. The NFL loves average. Just won the Super Bowl? Sorry, you're going to the very back of the draft line in every round. Amassing too much talent on that roster? Sorry, but the salary cap will ensure that you cannot keep all of it. This ain't the 1980s. Racking up too many victories? Sorry, but your schedule will very likely be appreciably harder next season, especially as it relates to your divisional foes. Regression to the mean fosters football chaos. Sorry, I meant competitive balance. It's part of the league's not-so-secret sauce, offering hope to all 32 fan bases, and why the playoff field typically changes significantly year over year. Yet this is also the very reason to reward teams that manage to remain a standard deviation or two beyond average. And I'm talking about the good ones, not the New York Jets. If you can achieve excellence in the NFL, you should be applauded for it. This is why I was heartened to see a week ago last Wednesday that the Detroit Lions, a franchise long relegated to middling, if not the Jet side of the bell curve, proposed a change to the present postseason format that I've thought was long overdue. Namely, it's compensating the best teams with better seeds and home playoff games rather than rewarding those that merely win divisions. The Lions are asking the NFL to amend the current playoff seeding format to allow wildcard teams to be seeded higher than division champions if the wildcard team has a better regular season record. Detroit's plan further lays out that higher seed teams host postseason games, regardless of whether they are division champions or wildcard entries. Let's go back to the 1980s again. It was a time when things like network news, landlines, and Congress mattered. It's also when the NFL was constructed of six divisions, RIP, AFC Central, and NFC Central, most of them comprised of at least five clubs. That meant fully half of the team's 16-game regular season schedule was spent matching up with divisional foes and rendered a first-place finish a little more consequential and its guaranteed home playoff game perhaps a touch more meaningful. And nowadays, the NFL went to 8 four-team divisions when it expanded to 32 franchises in the year 2002. Hello, Houston Texans, RIP Houston Oilers, which meant clubs only spent 37.5% of the schedule competing against their traditional rivals. That figure dropped to 35% when the 17th game was added in the year 2021. The modern math indicates that when a division is consistently ruled by a 9-win team, looking at you, Tampa Bay Buccaneers, it's actually just a bad division, not a case where a bunch of good squads are beating the tar out of one another the way that the Dallas Cowboys, New York Giants, Philadelphia Eagles, and Washington did way back when such a thing was allowed in the body bag heyday of the 1980s and 90s NFC East, which also included the always irrelevant St. Louis/Phoenix Cardinals. Mediocrity in the 21st century NFL is too easily elevated. Let's drill down a bit more on the NFC South. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers have won it each of the past four seasons, meaning that they've been assured at least one home playoff game all of those years. Not once in that period has the NFC South produced a wild card team. Its most recent one, actually, the 2020 Tom Brady-led Buccaneers, who won Super Bowl 55. Over the past three seasons, Tampa Bay's regular season record is 27 wins, 24 losses. Yet, the Bucs have wound up with the third or fourth playoff seed each time, even though their overall conference record has never been better than sixth and was tied for ninth in the year 2022. Is the arc of the football universe bending towards justice when the Minnesota Vikings finish 14 wins, 3 losses as they did last year, the most regular season wins ever by a wild card team, but are seeded fifth and basically having no hope of playing a postseason game in front of their home fans, even though they had tied for the NFC's second-best record? Unrelated but related, a similarly wonky seeding system led to unexpected outcomes in the new college football playoff earlier this year when Boise State and Arizona State were slotted third and fourth, respectively, by virtue of winning weak conferences. Neither team was in the top seven of the final regular season top 25 poll. In each of the last three NFL postseasons, at least one wild card team in both the AFC and the NFC has had a superior record to the division-winning number four seed, and in many cases, multiple clubs have been better. I'm not suggesting winning a division should not lead to automatic playoff qualification. That ought to remain the case. But those so-called champions should have to earn the higher seed and home dates that come with them. Which brought me to another realization and a belated point. When I saw this proposal had come from the Detroit Lions, my first reaction was that they had felt some sort of compassion for their NFC North brethren Vikings, whom Detroit swept last season to win the division and the number one playoff seed. There was also that caught-on-camera moment at Ford Field in Week 18 when the Lions beat the Vikings in the regular season finale, and Detroit coach Dan Campbell told Minnesota counterpart Kevin O'Connell, quote, "I'll see you in 2 weeks," unquote, an innocuous but nevertheless highly parsed comment made following the heat of battle, and also one that would have been true had the seeding held to form. Even though the matchups didn't materialize as they were designed to, it does become apparent that the Detroit Lions' proposal would also generally benefit their self-interests, and number one seeds should be deservedly granted plenty of indulgence, beyond earning a first-round bye and home field advantage. The NFL's playoffs dictate that the highest seed always hosts the lowest remaining seed as the rounds progress. But the current setup would have theoretically meant that Detroit would have played the wildcard Vikings a third time, despite Minnesota's gaudy record, even though the higher-seeded Rams and Bucks both finished 10 wins, 7 losses, and would have been logically, if not practically in this case, more attractive matchups for a top-seeded host team. The NFL is nothing if not an organism that constantly evolves in a bid to create a more attractive product. And that includes occasional tweaking of a playoff system that has generally been the best in professional sports for the last half century or so, given its one-and-done nature. But it is not always perfect. Remember, the undefeated 1972 Dolphins somehow had to go on the road to win the AFC Championship game back when it was hosted on a rotational basis rather than on a merit-based one. And again, that feature is entitled Detroit Lions Are Right. NFL playoffs are long due for an overhaul, written by Nate Davis of USA Today. And in other NFL news, headline reads, Philadelphia Eagles defensive end Graham retires after 2 titles, 15 seasons. And this feature written by Jacob Kamenker of USA Today. Brandon Graham is retiring after 15 seasons with the Philadelphia Eagles, he announced last week. I gave everything I had in this, and I don't have any regrets, Graham told reporters. The Eagles congratulated Graham on his retirement with a social media post shortly after his announcement. Quote, one of the best to ever wear the midnight green, the Eagles wrote. Thank you for 15 incredible seasons, Brandon Graham, unquote. Graham was a first-round pick by the Eagles in the 2010 NFL Draft and spent his entire 15-season career in Philadelphia. The Michigan product played 206 career regular season games with 106 starts and totaled 76.5 regular season sacks, good for the third most in Eagles history, behind only Reggie White and Trent Cole. Graham won 2 Super Bowls with the Eagles. He notably strip-sacked Tom Brady in the Eagles' 41-33 Super Bowl 52 win over the New England Patriots while logging a single tackle in Philadelphia's 40-22 Super Bowl 59 victory over the Kansas City Chiefs. Graham, now age 35, returned early from a torn triceps that he suffered in Week 12 to play in Super Bowl 59. That ended up being his last ever NFL game. The Eagles already lost defensive lineman Milton Williams and Josh Sweat in free agency. They will need to further replenish their depth with Graham's career over. Only 4 active NFL players remain in the league from the 2010 NFL draft after Graham's retirement: Trent Williams, Kareem Jackson, Jerry Hughes, and Linval Joseph. And again, that feature entitled Eagles defensive end Graham retires after 2 titles and 15 seasons. And in other football news, headline reads, Enriched Bengals, Jamar Chase, and T. Higgins may cost others. In this feature written by Nate Davis of USA Today. One of the more fascinating pieces of off-season NFL business in 2025 emerged that Cincinnati Bengals wide receivers Jamar Chase and T. Higgins had jointly agreed to long-term contract extensions to remain with a franchise that has historically struggled to sustain success. Regardless, the core triumvirate, including quarterback Joe Burrow of what could be the league's most fearsome passing attack, is locked up for the foreseeable future, which means some serious winners in the Queen City and also some significant losers. Among the winners, of course, Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins. Collectively, they're the most expensive wideout duo in NFL history, per reports. Chase, who won the receiving Triple Crown in 2024 with his 127 catches for 1,708 yards and 17 touchdowns, all pacing the league, landed a four-year, $161 million pact to become the best-compensated non-quarterback ever. His $40.3 million average annual salary tops the one that Cleveland Browns defensive end Myles Garrett recently signed. Higgins' four-year, $115 million deal ranks among the 10 richest in the wideout space. It is especially impressive negotiating from his and Chase's agent, Rocky Arsenault, given Higgins has only played two full seasons during his five-year NFL career and has never caught even 75 balls in a campaign. Also among the winners is Micah Parsons. Just as Garrett set the bar for Chase, he may well have done the same for Micah Parsons. The Dallas Cowboys All-Pro linebacker is due $24 million in 2025, the fifth-year option of his rookie contract. And given procrastinating team owner Jerry Jones's propensity to grant top-of-market payouts, Parsons seems squarely in line to benefit next from that approach, particularly with Jones sitting on approximately $40 million of cap space following recent restructures to the deals of Dak Prescott and CeeDee Lamb. Another winner among the free agent market, Mike Gesicki. The tight end, who only started three games in 2024, recently reached his own three-year extension with Cincinnati after catching 65 passes for 665 yards in his first year with the organization. Those numbers could very well spike given the attention that Chase and Higgins will continue to command, especially since Gesicki should enjoy massive feeding grounds in the middle of the field on any given Sunday during the season. And among the losers in the NFL, could one say that Joe Burrow is one of them? The quarterback remarkably finished fourth in last season's MVP race, even though the Bengals didn't even make the playoffs. He did lead the NFL with 460 completions, 652 pass attempts, 4,918 yards, and 43 touchdowns through the air, numbers somewhat a byproduct of necessity given Cincinnati's rampant defensive struggles. Yet Burrow may have to be even better in 2025. Does that mean challenging Hall of Famer Peyton Manning's single-season records for passing yards and touchdowns, now that his demands have essentially been granted despite a largely unchanged roster's remaining flaws? But is that realistic to expect, or even fair? Oh, wait, no one ever said that the NFL is fair. Also among the individual losers in the NFL, Justin Jefferson, the Minnesota Vikings All-Pro and Chase's college teammate at LSU, set the bar for wideout money last June with a four-year pact averaging $35 million. Chase badly wanted to top it in 2024, if only by $1 annually, but has now put that bar out of sight. Jefferson is unlikely to seek an adjustment anytime soon, and his numbers may not warrant that for a while anyway, as his team pivots to quarterback J.J. McCarthy, who has yet to throw a regular season pass in the NFL. Then among the losers, there's also Trey Hendrickson. The Bengals' all-pro defensive end and league's defensive player of the year runner-up in 2024 continues to await his own financial resolution, one that Burrow also pleaded for. He is owed $16 million in 2025, the final year of Hendrickson's contract, and well shy of what premium pass rushers make, basically 40% of what Garrett will average over the life of his extension. But given the windfall that Chase and Higgins just caught, what's left for Hendrickson, who's been permitted to seek a trade that hasn't yet materialized? Maybe the Bengals figure out a way to come through here, and maybe this is headed for an ugly summer showdown that could precipitate another early season distraction that costs Cincinnati dearly in the win column yet again. And again, that feature entitled Enriched Bengals Chase and Higgins May Cost Others, written by Nate Davis of USA Today. That's all the time that we have for this edition of Sports Today. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a great evening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.